Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in this week's show, WFPL's Robin Fisher talks with NASA's Don Yeomans about the facts and myths of asteroids.
So they're not, I mean, they always get bad press because they do have this annoying habit of running into us from time to time. That's Mother Nature's way of keeping us scientists on our toes, I guess. But they're also enormously important for science, for our current position atop the food chain, and for the future exploration of space.
Also, WFPL Stephanie Sanders talks with Ira Glass of This American Life about his new venture into television.
Whereas for television, if you want to get to that point, you totally have to, like, gear up a huge machine of things to happen.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
The story has to be just right, and the photography has to be just right, and the look of the person's face has to be just right, and then you can kind of make it happen. But you got to be so careful.
Now, the news. Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear from This American Life host Ira Glass. He spoke with WFPL Stephanie Sanders about the difference between telling a story on the radio and telling a story on TV, and what has made his venture into television an eye-opening experience. First, though, we've seen those movies or read the books where the killer asteroid slams into Earth and destroys life as we know it. But could that really happen? And what is an asteroid, anyway? Or a comet? WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with Don Yeomans, manager for NASA's Near-Earth Object Program, about asteroids, comets, and why we should care about them.
I have to start at the beginning and ask you, what is the difference between an asteroid and a comet?
Well, asteroids are usually rocks, rocky material, that are left over from the inner solar system formation process, and comets are icy and dusty bits and pieces that are left over from the outer solar system formation process.
And tell me what you mean by inner solar system and outer solar system.
Well, okay, in the inner solar system, we have the planets Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, and then we have a giant belt of asteroids between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, and Jupiter is sort of the dividing line between the outer solar system. Those are the gas giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune.
Now, are there other NEOs or near-Earth objects besides asteroids and comets?
No. The near-Earth object population, those objects that are in the Earth's neighborhood, are mostly asteroids, rocky bodies, occasionally some icy comets as well.
Did asteroids and or comets play any role in Earth's formation?
Well, yeah. When some 4.5 billion years ago, when the Earth and the rest of the solar system was forming, these bits and pieces of rock and ice were coming together, agglomerating, as we say, to form the inner planets. And the leftover bits and pieces are what we now call asteroids. And so these objects running into the Earth, it should be no surprise. That's how the Earth formed in the first place.
And are they busy out there while we're talking now, forming other planets, possibly in other galaxies?
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, in other star systems, planets are almost certainly forming. In our own solar system, the planet formation process is complete, as far as we know.
And how do we know that? Or,
well, the disk of material from which the planets formed has been depleted to such an extent that there's really no way that another planet could form in our solar system. In fact, the asteroids, had it not been for Jupiter, which sort of mixed things up, the asteroids in the asteroid belt could have formed a planet between Mars and Jupiter, but Jupiter formed so quickly that and stirred things up that didn't allow those asteroids to form into another planet.
I know that you all use the term a potentially hazardous asteroid, and is that as threatening as it sounds?
Well, those potentially hazardous objects are objects that can get within, about 5 million miles of the Earth's orbit. And that's a distance that's large by Earth standards, but by celestial standards, the gravitational effects of the Earth and Mars and Jupiter can easily move an orbit by that distance. So we say those objects that are within 5 million miles of the Earth's orbit are potentially hazardous because one of the planets could gravitationally move one of these objects that distance in a few revolutions around the sun.
Now, I read quite a bit about an asteroid Apophis.
Oh, yeah. That's the poster child for near-Earth objects. It's going to get real close in 2029 on April 13th, Friday the 13th, mind you. It's actually going to get so close that it's going to pass below the altitude of our geosynchronous satellites. It'll become a naked-eye object briefly on the 13th of April in 2029. So it's a very close shot over the bow by an object that's about 470 meters in extent.
Well, first I have to ask, how do you know April 13th, 2029?
Well, that's our job. We take the observations of the object, position observations of where it is in the solar system, and we use those observations to compute an orbit and then run the computer extrapolations forward to see where they'll be in the next 100 years. And this one happens to get very close to the Earth in 2029.
And you said it would be visible to the naked eye. Whereabouts?
Well, you'd have to go to Europe or Northern Africa to see it with the naked eye. It won't be visible in nighttime in the United States. So get your tickets early.
So, so Apophis is headed this way.
That's right.
What do we do?
Well, we enjoy the show. It's not a threat in 2029. However, if it passes through a very narrow region of space, only 600 meters long, it would return and actually collide with the Earth in 2036. But the chances of that happening are very, very remote.
Let's say we do detect an asteroid that is headed our way. What are the options for deflecting it or destroying it, or how do we handle that?
Well, that's a good question. In the unlikely situation where we do find an object that's on an Earth-threatening trajectory, there's a number of existing technologies that could be used if we find them early enough. Obviously, if you find an object that's going to collide next week, there's not much you can do. But our goal, NASA's goal, is to find these objects decades in advance of any threatening Earth encounter. And then there's a number of options you could use. You could simply run into it, as we did with the Deep Impact spacecraft. We ran into a comet Tempel 1 on July 4th of 2005. And if it's an object that's only a few hundred meters, the impact of the spacecraft would be enough to slow it down so that in 10 or 20 years when it was predicted to hit the Earth, it would miss. Or there's another option that's kind of interesting. If it's small enough, you could actually back up to it with a large spacecraft and use the gravitational attraction between the asteroid and the spacecraft to sort of tug it along.
Is that what's known as the gravity tractor?
Yes, that's right. That's a gravity tractor. And that works if you have a long lead time and a fairly small threatening object.
So if you change the asteroid's trajectory, or if you slow it down, then Earth will keep moving the way it normally moves, so that by the time the asteroid gets to it, it's gone?
Exactly. Exactly. You just slow it down a millimeter or two per second, or speed it up so that in 10 or 20 years, when it's predicted to hit the Earth, you will have moved it enough in that intervening time so that it would actually miss.
We've all heard about the asteroids hitting the Earth and destroying the dinosaurs, but when was the last major impact on Earth sort of in human times?
Well, there was quite an event on June 30th, 1908, a so-called Tunguska event that occurred in Russian Siberia. It leveled trees for 2,000 square kilometers. Fortunately, there was no people nearby, although one gentleman was knocked off his porch some 60 miles away, and some reindeer were taken out. But that such a remote area of Siberia that it took 19 years for a expedition to get there, and even then, 19 years later, the devastation was quite apparent. Trees were leveled for miles in all directions. So it was a blast roughly 1,000 times more energetic than the Hiroshima atomic blast. Mother Nature has quite an arsenal.
I assume when they come through, regardless of their size, I assume that when they come through the atmosphere and they hit the Earth, they are hot.
Well, when they're passing through the Earth's atmosphere, they are indeed hot. And this one was only 60 meters. This Tunguska event was only 60 meters in extent. So it actually was what we call an air blast. The pressure on the front side of this thing was so much more than the pressure on the back side that it actually exploded a few miles above the Earth's surface never did reach the ground.
Do they have dangerous chemicals in them, or, you know, like the sci-fi movies where they're radiating? Or
No, they're mostly, the asteroids are mostly silicate rock, some of the minerals that are common on Earth. There's nothing sinister about these things. They're not radioactive or have any strange minerals that we're not familiar with.
What's our ultimate goal in studying the NEOs?
Well, they're important from a number of points of view. Scientifically, they're important because they are the remnants of the early solar system formation process. So if you want to study the chemical mix from which our planets, including the Earth, formed, you'd like to study these objects because they haven't changed a great deal. They likely delivered much of the water and the carbon-based molecules to Earth that allowed life to form. And as you noted, subsequent collisions of these objects with the Earth punctuated evolution so that it allowed the most adaptable species, like us, to rise to the top of the food chain. And they may offer opportunities for future interplanetary exploration. If you're going to build structures in space, you're not going to build them on the Earth and then launch them. You're going to get up there and look around for raw materials, and asteroids have minerals, metals, comets have water, ice, so you could use the water ice to break it down into hydrogen and oxygen, which is the most efficient form of rocket fuel. So comets and asteroids might provide the structures and watering holes and fueling stations for future interplanetary travel.
So if we can figure out a way to harvest them.
Yeah,
they could.
Yeah, exactly. So they're not, I mean, they always get bad press because they do have this annoying habit of running into us from time to time, that's Mother Nature's way of keeping the scientists on our toes, I guess. But they're also enormously important for science, for our current position atop the food chain, and for the future exploration of space.
I know there have been quite a few reports coming out that funding is being cut back for the NEO program, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that and where do we go from here?
Well, we just completed a report that was given to Congress suggesting that we have a next generation of search. The current NASA program is centered on finding the 1-kilometer-sized objects, about a half a mile-sized objects and larger, because if they hit, they would be a worldwide problem, not just a local problem. So the current search programs are focused upon finding the large ones. And this report to Congress suggested that we extend that search down to the 140-meter-sized objects, about a football field and a half-sized objects, and because they're far more numerous. And while they wouldn't cause a global problem if they hit, they would certainly be a devastation locally over several states. And if they hit in the ocean, you could cause tsunamis, of course. So the report requested the authority to go forward with this extended search, and NASA pointed out in the cover letter of the report that they don't currently have the budget to do this extended search. So we still have the $4 million a year that's being spent on the current survey, so that wasn't taken away. It's just that we don't currently have the money to extend the search from the large ones to the smaller ones that are far more frequent.
So there's no new money but the old money is still there.
That's correct.
Not to be alarmist, but to ask, let's say a football field size asteroid hits. What is the impact? I mean, how does that change things, other than obviously create a big hole in the ground?
It does more than that. It's the energy of a 140 meter sized object, or something like Apophis. Let's take Apophis, 270 meters. You would expect something like that to get as close as it will be in 2029, every 525 years. It would have an impact energy of about 400 megatons, which is megatons of a TNT explosive, which is much, much larger than any nuclear weapon we have. And it would be... The devastation over a fairly wide region, and if it hit in the ocean, it would cause a tsunami that would affect the shorelines dramatically and do a lot of infrastructure damage. So it's not just putting a hole in the ground. It's causing regional devastation and or a tsunami type effect. And if it's a large one, if it's a kilometer or larger, then the effects are global. Then you toss up enough ejecta in the atmosphere that the sunlight gets shut down and the plants die and the animals that thrive on those plants die. So it's then you're talking about an extinction event. But fortunately, the number of large ones is only about 1,000, whereas the number of 140-meter-sized objects and larger is 100,000. So there's fortunately few of the large ones. But they do the most damage, of course.
And we're keeping our eye on those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the plan, is to find the vast majority of those large ones. That's the current plan, is to find the vast majority of these large ones. And we found about 70% of them, and we're tracking them, and none of them represent a threat in the near future. So our plan to Congress was to extend this search down to the 140-meter-sized objects that could cause regional damage. And to date, that money hasn't been allocated.
Well, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with Don Yeomans, manager for NASA's Near Earth Objects program. Yeomans will present his lecture, Near Earth Objects, Finding Them Before They Find Us, Monday evening, 7:30, at the University of Louisville's Rauch Planetarium. The event is free and open to the public. When we come back, This American Life's Ira Glass explains why his new TV show is different than what you expected and why you'll like it all the same. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up a little later in the show, we'll hear from Elizabeth Hickey, a Louisville native who has recently released her second novel, The Wayward Muse. But first, his is probably one of the most recognizable voices in public radio today.
Television is at the center of our culture. It is hard to avoid, God knows. What does it do to us anyway? Well, from WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life, distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Ira Glass. Our show today, What We Learn from Television. Our show recorded in front of live audiences.
Ira Glass has been crafting stories for his radio show, This American Life, for more than 10 years. Last week, that show took a great leap into the realm of television with the premiere of This American Life on Showtime. WFPL Stephanie Sanders talked to Glass about the difference in telling a story on the radio and telling it on television, thinking about the world in more ways than just the way it sounds, and why an overcast day is a lighting director's best friend.
Are you pleased with how the project has turned out so far?
Yes, like shockingly so. I mean, and truthfully, like, we went into it very skeptical and unsure, you know, if we should even do it. And really unsure what it would be like to work with a TV network and just am very worried that it could be done at all. And And in the end, I feel like we've made something as close to the radio show as we could possibly make it. And when we've been going around the country, we did a six-city tour showing it to public radio audiences, and there would be a moment at the beginning where I'd say, like, were you worried about, you know, us doing a TV show? And people would roar back, like, yes! Like, they really thought it was, like, This American Life Special Victims Unit.
Right.
And then we would show them the stuff, and I feel like we would show them the stuff, and I feel like we won them over.
Well, I mean, does it look at all, because I know you, I'm sure, you know, you just said you were skeptical, but I'm sure you had preconceptions of what you wanted it to look like in your head. Does it look like at all what you thought it would, or is it totally different?
I mean, truthfully, I think I didn't know enough to have preconceptions that were very big. Like when I talked about it, you know, before we ever did it, I was just like, well, I wanted it to be like impressionistic or sort of dreamy or like an old school rock video, you know. And like honestly, like that turned out to be completely wrongheaded. You know, like I just thought, like, well, you want the images to create this sort of dream of some sort, like the way that you have kind of a dream when you listen to the radio, you know, like just imagining the thing. And in fact, like what the guys designed, our cinematographer and our director designed, was so much better than I could have imagined. They did this thing where they said, like, okay, one of the things about the radio show is that the radio show is very reflective. There are these moments where people reflect on, like, what just happened to me? You know what I mean? Like, what does it mean? What does it say about the world? And they said to do it as a TV show, they said you literally can't do it. It won't feel like the same show unless you have those moments of reflection on the TV show. And they said, like, well, how do you do that on TV? Like, what do you look at? And they said, well, what you look at is they created these images, so they shot it like a movie. So it's widescreen, and it's beautifully lit, and it's beautifully composed, and the camera is on a tripod, very, very still. And it's just, like, very beautiful, very sort of stately kinds of images. And the way, like, they used to say, they said, like, you know how the music works on our radio shows, so the music just sort of makes everything more intense. They're like, well, the images should work that way, too. Like, that's what the images should do. And that's what they did.
I did notice that when I was watching some of the episodes that were on the preview CD, or DVD, I'm sorry, that the colors are very pleasing, but it's not exactly, I would say, not exactly how you would see things if you were just standing right there, but I think it's more beautiful to look at, but also, you know, I was thinking, when I first started watching, I was thinking, why are we getting so many of these, like, establishing shots? And then I was like, oh, yeah, this is good because I can think about what was just said or where we're going with this or what the transition is supposed to be here.
Yeah, like, it definitely looks better on film than if you're just standing there. Like, there would be...
Yeah.
And truthfully, like, I didn't understand what it means to have, like, a cinematographer. But, like our guy would walk in and he was like, he'd go, like, can I move this lamp? And he would move a catch. And we were tiny, tiny crews. You know, we were just, like just three or four of us. You know, he would just, like, move a thing or two around, and you look through the viewfinder, and it'd be like, what did you do? Like it looks like a movie. It's so crazy. And, yeah. And the thing you're saying about the establishing shots, like, that was something, that, like, at the very beginning, I said to the director of, like, I don't want establishing shots. And that really horrified him. He's like, what are you talking about? You don't want that? It's one of the tools of cinema. And I was like, no, I want it to be like the radio show where you just feel like I'm right in the middle of it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm right in the middle, and it's happening all around me. And I don't know. So for some of them, they're establishing shots. Right.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about the story with Chance, the bull, and the difference between the radio story and the television story there. Because I heard the radio story well before I saw the TV story, which I watched last night. But I kind of left them with different feelings at the end. Do you feel that they turned out differently?
That's funny. I've never actually sort of done them back to back. I mean, the radio story. Wow. I mean, my feelings about the story are the same, and so I'd be curious, like, what seemed different to you?
Well, I didn't really do them back to back. I probably heard the radio story maybe 2 or 3 months ago, and then saw the television story last night. And I guess I just, I don't know. I think I felt more sorry for the man at the end of it. At the end of the TV story, and I felt more endeared to him at the end of the radio story.
Wow, that is really interesting. I mean, I could see how you would feel more sorry for him at the end of the TV, because in the course of the story, he has this bull and he loves the bull, and the bull tries to kill him. And in the TV version, like you see what that means more. Like on the TV version, you see the bull.
Right.
You know, like the bull is sort of like a ghost character in the radio version. Like there's no way to sort of bring him there in 3D very well. And then in the TV version, you see Ralph, the guy, get gored. You see what he looks like after he gets gored, anyway. And he just looks all beat up, and he looks so sort of weary and beat. And so your heart definitely goes out to him.
Yeah, and I think definitely, because I was talking about how pretty the imagery is and things like that when you're on the farm and you're showing old footage and things like that. But then when he's in the hospital, it's got like that hospital halogen like glow on him, And I was just like, man, look where this guy is now,
Like he should be there at all. I know that blue fluorescent light thing.
Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about.
It's interesting that you found him more endearing on the radio version. I wonder if that's just literally the intimacy of radio.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is.
Wow.
I'm with you where before I was watching, I was a little skeptical, and that was like the number one thing. If you'd asked me last week before I watched a couple episodes of the TV stories, that was like the number one thing that I wanted to talk to you about was, the skepticism of switching mediums like that. So this is a perfect segue. Talk to me a little bit about this one clip that I have about when you realized while you were doing the bull story and some of the clips and things that happened during that, you realize that pictures may be able to add a little something that radio doesn't.
We were shooting that story and Ralph got gored and we're in the hospital room and afterwards, and we're shooting that, just talking to him and filming and later when we were looking at the footage, there's this one moment where Ralph sort of picks up this toy that had arrived that a visitor had given him, and he gives this little speech, brave little speech about he's going to get back out there, and he's going to fix this.
Sandra, hand me that horse, would you? How does he work? Wait. That's how I feel right now. I'm going to walk out of here tomorrow, the next day, and I'll go right back out there and give him another bucket of feed. I mean, that's what you have to do.
Yeah. There's a moment right at the end there where he finishes that speech, and he just, you don't hear it on the radio, but he just gets this look on his face of just complete weariness, like this look of utter weariness and vulnerability crosses his face, and it's just heartbreaking. And it was funny because we were cutting this thing together, and seeing that was the very first time the thought literally ever occurred to me of like, oh, the pictures could add something to the story. Like, it never even occurred to me. Like, I thought like the pictures would be nice, but I thought it would be like the music in the radio show. I'd just make it more intense. But anyway, I think through like, when you see somebody's face, you know what I mean? Like looking at their face when they're really having an emotional moment, it's every bit as expressive as the radio. Like one of the most intense things on the radio, the most intense thing on the radio for sure, is if somebody is just talking in a very bare way about something that means so much to them. The voice carries so much feeling, and it's just nothing more gripping. And in a way, like to have the camera super close up on Ralph in the blue light of the hospital room and the wide screen, and he just gets that look on his face. I mean, it's very much like that. Like, I feel like it's one of the few times in the TV context where you can have the intimacy that you get of radio. I mean, mostly you don't. Like the fact that you were feeling so much more endeared to him on the radio, I feel like it's just like it's because the default position for radio is it's just intimate. It's just personal. Like, you just can't get around it before you do anything. Like, that's what it wants to be. Whereas for television, if you want to get to that point, you totally have to, like, gear up a huge machine of things to happen.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
The story has to be just right, and the photography has to be just right, and the look of the person's face has to be just right, and then you can kind of make it happen. But you got to be so careful. Yeah, it's really a difference.
Do you find it more difficult to get those raw, pure moments out of people with the TV crew behind you?
It's funny. I thought it would be harder than it was. Like as it turns out, like we it was about the same percentage of time. I mean, anybody who interviews any people for a living knows that, like, some people they're going to open up, and some people they're never going to open up, and then there's kind of like a range of people in the middle that on like a good day you'll be able to get them to talk honestly, and it felt like we were hitting about the same percentages with the TV crews as with the radio.
Has there and I'm not sure, was the I have this clip with the 9/11 widow. She was strictly with the television show, right? She wasn't on anything on the radio.
Yeah, no. Like the only stories that appear on the TV show and the radio show are the stories that are in the pilot, and just because we just in the first episode, and just because we didn't know if that was ever going to be on TV, and we just wanted to put the stories on the air.
And I didn't feel as though those were jokes that weren't relatable to me. They were like, why couldn't you get that? That's a joke. It was like 1, 2, 3. There was setup. There was payoff. Like, that was a joke.
But seriously, I really do miss Michael a lot. It's been a very tough year. So now what I do is I turn on Monday Night Football because it makes me think of him, reminds me of him. And now when I yell out his name and he doesn't answer, it's just like he's still here.
At the beginning, it's just a few minutes at the beginning of the Growth Spurt episode. And I found myself at the end of kind of your little talking to her and showing a little bit of her stand-up and things like that, I just felt, you know, I felt awkward for her, but I also found myself wanting to talk to her more and be able to understand her. Do you feel that way? Do you feel, I guess, maybe restricted by time at all with this?
No, I don't actually. No, if you were feeling that way, that's just a complete failure of craft on our part.
Oh, no.
It has nothing to do with the inherent qualities of television. It just means that we screwed up. No. Like, because we made longer versions of that story about her,
mm-hmm.
And we just thought, like, oh, well, no, it's the beginning of the show. We should probably move it along. Like, you know, just like I liked the longer versions, though my coworkers on the radio show, like, we said, like, well, maybe this should be a little shorter, and so we trimmed it down. No, maybe we made the wrong choice.
Well, I hate that I pointed that out now.
I mean, I gotta say, it's no different than the radio show. You know, like you know, when we start the radio show, you know, every week we start with a little story, and that story usually has to wind up between, you know, in 3 to 5 minutes, and so often those are super abbreviated stories. So that's no different than the radio. We absolutely are capable of screwing up in either.
Do you? A lot of times when I'm out with friends or, you know, with my family or something like that, I'll hear something and I'll say, that would sound great to tell, you know, this story or that story or something like that. And my family jokes that I live in a radio world, like I have radio goggles on and I just hear things that sound good and things like that. Are you turning into a person who sees things as in a television world?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, like sometimes in the real world, like I'll look around and I'll notice, like now, like after working with people who have to shoot pictures, you notice the light. You notice light in a way, like in the way that I mean, I didn't know this, but the way that a real cinematographer understands light is so minute. Like we would be going out to shoot just like the little openings where I say, you know, it's This American Life, and so it's not that complicated of a thing to perform. And we would go out on these shoots for those things to make them look as beautiful as they look. I mean, we would go on these big, there would be big crews of 9 or 10 people. And our cinematographer would get to the spot and it would be, you know, it would be still dark. We'd be waiting for the sun to come up. And he would say, like, okay, so the sun is going to rise from that spot over there. like he knew, like, where the sun rose. And he goes, and then it's going to start rising at 7 a.m. But we're not going to want to start shooting until the light changes at 7:25. And he says, at that point, the sun is going to be at that spot in the sky right there. And what I'm going for is this color of light. We're going to filter the like lenses so as to like accent that even more. And it's like your relationship to the sky. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was always just like interested in overcast days. Like overcast days is the cinematographer's friend. You know what I mean? Like everything looks better over when there's overcast.
That's interesting.
I didn't know that. And now that I know that, like, I'll totally notice. I'll be outside walking around, and I'll notice how the light looks in on an overcast day. Like, so that kind of thing is just, it's kind of fun to be able to notice something new about the world that you never noticed before.
Do you have a favorite of the TV stories?
I have a favorite. Yeah, I absolutely do.
What is it?
There's a story, and I think this is going to be in the second episode that airs, though it's actually in the fifth episode we made. And it's a story about this 14-year-old kid named Joe who has decided that he will never fall in love. And he's in eighth grade, and he's looked at all of his friends falling in love, and he's just like, this is nonsense. This can lead to no good for anybody. People getting their hearts broken, and people just like getting all excited about what seems so silly to him, and so he has come to believe that love is a scam perpetrated upon us. And it wouldn't be a good story, except he is so funny and personable and really smart, and he has totally worked up this theory. And every adult around him, of course, says, "Well, you're just going through a phase," and he has an answer for that. And it's just one of these things where it's an interview, just like my favorite interviews on the radio show, where he's just so deeply charming, and you learn so much about him, and there are these weird little funny moments where he says stuff, and so it's got that. And then at the same time, we did this story about halfway through the series, halfway into shooting the series, and just the way it's shot achieves a lot of the things that the cinematographer and the director were trying to do, where there are times where just the images just carry the story. It's just beautiful. It's just crazy. Like, the images just totally carry the whole thing. We did these little interviews with Joe's classmates out in the field behind his school, and they were just like, little, well, let's just try this, see if it works. And they turned out to be so completely intense and beautiful. And so there's just like a lot. There's a lot there that this is like, it's a very pleasing melding of the sensibility of the radio story and the incredible power of the cinematography and the directing.
That was WFPL Stephanie Sanders talking with This American Life's Ira Glass, who is still adjusting to the way things work in television.
So we're here in Utah, and
I'm getting the
back of my ears taped. The light apparently is coming through my ears, making them glow pretty, and we don't want them to glow pretty. Can I just say, on the radio, we never do this.
The episode Ira Glass mentioned in the interview will be on Showtime this Thursday night at 10:30. More information about Ira Glass, This American Life, the TV show, and This American Life, the radio show, can be found at our website. Go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619 under Select a Program. When we come back, WFPL's Robin Fisher talks to author Elizabeth Hickey about her second novel, The Wayward Muse. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Louisville native Elizabeth Hickey's second novel, The Wayward Muse, uses the real-life love triangle between painter Dante Gabriel Rossetti, his model Jane Morris, and artist William Morris as the setting for a richly imagined story. WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with Hickey about crafting fiction from fact, where she finds inspiration, and what it's like to read to the hometown crowd.
I want to start not with talking about your second book, The Wayward Muse, but I want to talk about you being a hometown girl. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about Louisville growing up here.
Well, let's see. I grew up in the East End near Seneca Park, and my mom's family goes way back in Louisville. I went to St. Matthew's Elementary and also Coleridge Taylor Elementary, and then I went to St. Francis Goshen and Atherton High School for a little while, and then I graduated from Kentucky Country Day, and I swam for Lakeside. That was my big activity. So you've
sort of been a little all over the city.
Yeah.
What's it like coming back to do a book signing? Is it sort of like old home week?
Well, it's probably more nerve-wracking than reading anywhere else, because, of course, you want to do well for everybody that you knew growing up. But it's also a lot of fun because you get to see people you haven't seen in years. You know, all my parents' friends come to the readings and family, and occasionally, you know, an old classmate will appear, and so that's really fun. I enjoy seeing people.
So you'll be in town soon for your second book, The Wayward Muse, mm-hmm. Which was released in March, and I want you to tell me a little bit about the historical figures behind the characters in the novel. It's historical fiction, and it sort of revolves around the art world.
Well, the three main characters involved in the love triangle, which makes up the story, are William Morris, who is the father of the arts and crafts movement. He was an English Victorian designer, and everybody knows his wallpaper, his textiles, his style, but not everybody seems to connect it with him, with William Morris. But he was an amazingly prolific and designer and thinker and poet and socialist. He was just an amazingly interesting character. And then he was close friends with Dante Gabriel Rossetti, the Pre-Raphaelite painter. And Dante Gabriel Rossetti specialized in painting beautiful women. And they were both working, painting the Oxford Union Debating Hall ceiling together when they met a 17-year-old girl named Jane Burden, who was poor and considered very ugly by the people in her town. But Rossetti decided that she was very beautiful and that she needed to model for him. So she came to the studio and modeled for the debating hall. And along the way, they fell in love, but he had another lady friend in London. And so he left Jane for that woman, and then she ended up marrying William Morris, which was a huge step up the social ladder for her. So that was quite a coup for a poor girl from the slums of Oxford to marry a wealthy gentleman like William Morris.
In the book, you get the impression that Rossetti sort of set a standard of beauty when he chose Jane Burden. Is that true?
That was one of the most fascinating things for me, was that it's like he just decided that she was an icon of beauty, and he convinced everybody else to believe the same thing. She was very famous in London after she married Morris. People wrote about her in the newspapers and drew pictures of her, and her social doings were chronicled, and she sort of set a certain style. She dressed very differently from the other women of the time, and she kind of created a style. And all the paintings that Rossetti did of her just catapulted her into this sort of exalted status as a great beauty.
Well, I do think it's interesting to look at the paintings now and how our vision of beauty has changed, because she has a very masculine look to her face.
Mm-hmm. I don't think she'd be considered a great beauty today at all. If you look at photographs of her, you know, she's kind of Frida Kahlo looking, with the dark brows knitted together and sort of a very severe look. But she wasn't considered a great beauty at the time until Rossetti decided that she was, so... you know, I guess sometimes that happens today. You know, Karl Lagerfeld or Oscar de la Renta will decide that so-and-so is beautiful, and we all come to believe it.
I know that you have a background in art history, but how do you go from that to seeing a painting or reading a true story and deciding to create a novel from that information?
Well, I majored in art history in college, but I always knew that I wanted to be a writer, so it was kind of a question of, you know, do I pick one or the other, or how do I combine the two? And I think I hit upon a really lucky combination with my first novel, The Painted Kiss, which was about Gustav Klimt. And so I got to do research on art, and I got to write fiction and explore the inner lives of these people. And so then when it came time to write another one, I was sort of on the lookout for another good story, and that would enable me to write about art also. So I think I found another really good story.
Tell me about your research process.
Well, I read a lot of biographies, and I read things. Well, I read about the Pre-Raphaelites. There are a lot of books about the Pre-Raphaelites. I read about William Morris. I read about Rossetti. I tried to read some about England at the time, sort of social history, for those particular details that, you know, really make you feel like you're there. You know, those things don't just appear in your brain. You sort of have to find them. And then I went to England, and I went to London, and went to the William Morris Gallery, which is his childhood home, which is now a museum. And I went and looked at, you know, Tudor House where Rossetti lived, and different places where they had lived. And then I went to Oxford, and went to Holywell Street, which is where Jane grew up, and tried to walk out the Iffley Road to find the violets, but the place is pretty built up since their time, so it's not quite the same.
Well, the book is very rich in detail, and for instance, with the violets, and it really comes to life, and it made me wonder, is there ever a point in your writing process where it becomes... consciously becomes fiction and a story, or do you ever run the risk of it becoming more of a history book?
That is definitely a risk, and I think what I tend to do is I tend to do a lot of research and sort of get the facts down, and then I try to put them out of my mind, because if I think about them too intently, or I try to make it too factual, then I sort of lose the magic that fiction provides. So I try to put that away for a while and just create the fiction, and because if you don't, then it can sort of be kind of dull.
Not much of a story.
Right.
Do you ever wonder about your reader, and if your reader will take at face value that your story is strictly factual?
I did a workshop recently with some people, and they were asking me what was true and what wasn't true about my first book, and I told them certain things, and they were shocked to discover that something wasn't true, because they just assumed reading the book that everything was true. And, you know, that's sort of a hazard, of an occupational hazard, that some people are going to be horrified to discover that not everything is true. But people are smart, and they can work out the complicated relationship between fact and fiction quite well.
Well, I think something wonderful about your book being based on paintings and real, quote, people, is that you can do the research. I mean, you can go and see the painting.
Mm-hmm.
While the character Rossetti is painting the painting, there is actually a real painting that you can look at in a book or online. It really brings the novel alive.
Well, I think it's very helpful to me as a writer. I'm a person who really needs to see things, and to be able to look at the painting, I feel like I can extrapolate a lot of emotional detail from just looking at his work, and so that helps me a lot.
It's the type of book that will send the reader in search of more information.
Well, that you always hope.
How did you choose this particular story?
Well, I was sort of keeping my eye out for something interesting, and I've always admired William Morris. I've admired his design, and so I read a biography of Morris, and that's when I discovered that he had this unfaithful wife, and how that came to be. And the other detail that's very interesting is that he rented that house for the three of them, so Jane and Rossetti could be together. And then he went off to Iceland and left them there. And that seemed very confusing. You know, I'm not sure that today a man whose wife was having an affair would set them up in a house and let them be together and not, you know, he might beat the guy up or they might get a divorce, but this was a very unusual choice for the three of them, and so I was very interested in understanding how that came to be.
One thing that I thought was particularly interesting about the story is it is this love triangle, but it plays out as a classic fictional love story, you know, with the ugly duckling princess,
right.
And then you've got the prince, and then you sort of have the plotting prince that she doesn't want, and it really plays out as the classic love story.
It is kind of an archetypal story. The only problem I have with it is that I felt like it wasn't... I know that Morris didn't make Jane happy particularly, and that she really loved Rossetti, but it seemed like Rossetti wasn't really worthy, and so I'm not sure that there was a Prince Charming in the story. They were both, they both had elements of Prince Charming to them, but ultimately I felt like it was kind of sad that, you know, there wasn't, there wasn't the perfect happy ending for her.
Yeah, he certainly had the stereotype of the mad artist.
Yeah.
About him. So your next book, are you hard at work on your next book?
Well, I have some ideas. I'm hoping to incorporate the art angle with hopefully a contemporary character and maybe make it a little different than the last two. But I think I told you that I have a two-year-old son, so getting anything done is virtually impossible.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with Elizabeth Hickey about her latest novel, The Wayward Muse. Hickey will be reading from and signing the book at Carmichael's Bookstore on Frankfort Avenue Thursday evening at 7. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.